This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Isabella Pittaway with you for the Country Hour. Today on the show, what's in the federal budget for farmers? If you weren't glued to the television last night to watch Treasurer Josh Frydenberg hand down his first budget, don't worry, we're off to Canberra shortly. There'll be a boost to drought support, but there's no ag visa. I'd love to get your thoughts on what's in the budget for agriculture. Are farmers winners or losers? You can text us on 0467 842 722. Also today, Victoria's Dairy Lobby Group has asked the state government for cash flow assistance to help northern Victorian dairy farmers. That story is coming up right after the weather. But first though, it's been an intense summer for natural disasters across the country. Fires, floods and cyclones have lashed a largely drought-parched landscape. And this year's federal budget reflects how expensive it can be to clean up after these disasters hit. From Parliament House in Canberra, Clint Jasper and Kath Sullivan have this wrap of the budget.
Good afternoon from Parliament House in Canberra. Now, one of the biggest new items in this year's budget that will significantly affect the regions if it becomes a reality is the Emergency Response Fund. It's taking $3.9 billion from the Dormant Education Investment Fund, and the plan is to make about $150 million a year available up to 2023-24, and these funds will basically be able to be pulled out when existing disaster relief programs are exhausted. So that's a pretty big spend. It'll be managed by the Future Fund, and it's all aimed at cleaning up after these disasters, which we've had plenty of this summer.
Certainly have, Clint. And I think the really interesting thing about this is going to be how that relates to drought and whether drought is considered a natural disaster. Of course, this fund will sit next to a Future Drought Fund, which will be worth up to $5 billion. The government has certainly made a lot of that announcement since Prime Minister Scott Morrison brought that to the public's attention in November of last year.
We are waiting for details because there are none currently.
Look, we do want to wrap this quickly. A lot of the budget last night had previously been announced, particularly in terms of recovery for the cattle industry in northern Queensland following the flood. We do know there have been changes made to the farm household allowance throughout this current drought period. Last night it went a step further with $3 million in this year's budget to change the way that farmers' incomes are means tested when applying for the farm household allowance. Essentially what it means is if you're forced to sell your livestock, if you put those proceeds into a farm management deposit, they will not be considered as part of your eligibility for that FHA fortnightly payment.
We've had some statements from the opposition this morning and they're calling a bit of BS on that farm household allowance. They said basically every time the government has tinkered with the FHA, it's fallen short of farmers' expectations. And I guess if you were looking at the evidences, a lot of eligible farmers who haven't bothered to apply yet.
So there's fewer than 6,500 farmers across Australia who currently receive this payment. The National Farmers Federation says there's something like 85,000 farming families across the country. And that was certainly something that its president, Fiona Simpson, picked up on last night. Very keen to see the rest of the details of this farm household allowance review, which has been conducted across the country over the past couple of months.
Kath, I reckon two of the most exciting parts of this budget for farmers will be, one, the changes to the luxury car tax. Basically, if you're an eligible primary producer or tourism operator, from the middle of next year, election outcome dependent, of course, you'll be able to get a rebate on any luxury car tax you pay up to $10,000. Right now, it's about $3,000. So might see a few new farm vehicles roaming about the countryside.
When I read luxury, I think of limousines.
Yes.
But will it apply?
Also Land Cruisers.
It's interesting that asset tax write-off. I've been speaking with the Deputy Prime Minister. We'll hear from him shortly. He was really keen to talk about investment in silos on farm, which can also be written off. I think that is in part because they're manufactured, or a lot of them are manufactured in his electorate. But he said it's like Cape Canaveral when you have a look at all the silos popping up across his part of the world.
And specifically with that, there was an extension to that instant asset write-off. So if you're a business with less than $50 million of turnover a year, The instant asset write-off has been increased from $25,000 to $30,000. So that's a bit of a sweetener for small and medium businesses. But all of this, as I just mentioned, is dependent on the election outcome. And it's widely expected that the government will call an election before this week is over. And while we don't want to conflate state and federal issues, there were some worrying signs in the New South Wales state election for the Nats. You've just been speaking with the Deputy Prime Minister.
I certainly was. Surprisingly, he didn't want to talk about that too much. Michael McCormack and I have just sat down and I began by asking him how he'll remember this year's budget, and he said it's all about being back in black.
Back in black, surplus. Fantastic. First time for 12 years. Labor hasn't produced a surplus for 30 years, 1989. So, you know, but the fact is it's also a budget for regional Australia. It's also an infrastructure budget. So the $100 billion infrastructure figure is really significant.
Much has been said about the Nationals following the New South Wales election. There's this theory that you're on the nose. Do you think you've put enough money into regional Australia to convince Nationals voters to stick with you at the election?
Well, we're always going to put money into regional Australia. Regional Australia is hurting at the moment. There's no question. The drought has really taken its toll on regional communities, and particularly those in central, western, riverina areas that I represent, but indeed right throughout New South Wales, Queensland, Victoria, South Australia. I was in Western Australia last week and they're complaining too now that it's dry there. We've had a couple of decent showers in Wagga Wagga over the last fortnight, so 25 mils and then 28 mils following up, but a couple of showers aren't going to change the drought. And I really get perturbed when, not the ABC, but indeed you get some commercial channels, they'll have a bit of a shower of rain up in, you know, the northern areas of New South Wales. They'll get some Pitt Street farmer with his galoshes on and they'll go out and they'll do a report on the fact that, oh, the drought's broken. No, the drought's going to take many months, indeed years, to...
There wasn't actually that much new money for drought in last night's budget, though. You'd already announced the $5 billion future drought fund. We've seen increases to the access to the farm household allowance. Can farmers doing it tough expect any more support from this government?
Well, look, concessional loans, yes, and we will continue to monitor the drought and we'll continue to provide the tax relief. And I think that farmers would look at the tax relief we've already provided, the concessional loans that were part of the package last night and the Future Drought Fund, and say, yes, the government responded very quickly when the onset of the drought really took its toll.
Treasurer Josh Frydenberg announced a new natural disaster response fund, $3.9 billion. That's a lot of money. Is there any detail to go with that?
Well, look, when emergency disasters occur in the future, whether they're flood, fire, whatever the case might be, there's that fund for the government to fall back on. The fact is, when you're not in surplus and you have such incidents as the cyclone, which ravaged the top end of Australia, killing 500,000 cattle and, you know, washing away fences and other infrastructure, it really takes a hit on the bottom line. And, you know, we got $39 million out the door in the first week. And, of course, it's the assistance that we've provided and an incredible response by the Prime Minister and Linda Reynolds, I have to say. You know, they didn't ask for dockets and receipts for farmers. They just said, look, if they need the assistance, put $75,000 in their bank account, let them help them recover as quickly as they can.
There appear to be quite a few sweeteners or a lot of investment going toward Queensland. Can we expect you to be spending most of your time over this forthcoming election campaign in the Sunshine State?
Well, I'll be spending quite a bit of time. In fact, I'm looking forward to going to Michelle Landry's Capricornia electorate this Friday. Looking forward to addressing the Queensland Press Club this Friday. I'll be spending a bit of time in Queensland. We've got some outstanding members up there. A bit of New South Wales, Western Australia, Victoria, Tasmania as well. It's a new battlefront for the National Party. We've got some outstanding members down there. One senator and some outstanding candidates.
How do you walk both lines of this, both sides of the street, when you've got, it appears like, a different approach to policy coming from the Queensland members of your party compared to that from the South, and even from Western Australia? The state party there seems to be distancing itself from the federal party.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that anybody's distancing ourselves from the federal party. I mean, National Party people generally think alike on every issue. And if you ask me a question and you ask Matt Canavan a question, or if you ask Darren Chester a question, generally you'll get the same answer. We think very alike. What we want is lower energy prices. What we want is people to pay less tax. What we want is better roads. What we want is drought assistance, you know, when and where required.
And speaking of time, we don't have much left. But before we do wrap up our summary of the 2019-20 budget, Clint Jasper, I do think it's worth pointing to an agri spend in terms of biodiversity.
Yeah, this one is basically $30 million to initially work out a methodology to value biodiversity on farms, with the hope of eventually establishing a market for biodiversity credits, kind of like the way that carbon is traded. So it's a pretty forward-thinking and new announcement that looks like it's been, you know, $30 million to develop a methodology as some serious funding for that.
And something that Labor has sort of lent in principle support to as well. You and I met with industry leaders this morning, agriculture stakeholders, they like to call themselves. And while their general consensus was that the budget was...
bit meh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, for agriculture, nothing huge. There was certainly a lot of excitement for this biodiversity announcement, and more than one person told me that they think it has the potential to change the way we farm here in Australia.
National Farmers Federation, in its strategy looking forward to 2030, actually says it wants 5% of all farm incomes to come from
biophysical assets.
That's right. So trading these types of credits. So it's a kind of new frontier for Australian farmers.
Clint, thanks so much for helping me dissect this year's budget. Are you up for the opposition leader's budget reply tomorrow night?
Carl Sullivan, I will be out of the bubble and back at home, so I'll leave that one to you. And for now, we'll hand you back to the Country Hour.
Thanks to Clint Jasper and Kath Sullivan for that report. Let's hear what Victoria's Farm Lobby Group thought about the budget. I spoke to Victorian Farmers Federation Vice President Emma Germano earlier.
Well, I think it's probably neutral. Like, there was nothing completely disastrous in there. There was nothing overwhelmingly amazing in there either. But the coalition sound like they're being very benevolent in this budget. And I guess that's because we're leading into election. So, yeah, it is what it is.
One of the announcements was that there's going to be $30 million to expand access to international markets. How will that help fruit and vegetable growers, for example?
We're always looking for more and more market access. We've seen that when we have established market access in different countries, that some commodities that get access into those places really pick up and you see the benefits flowing on farm. So the more opportunities that we have to sell our produce, the better, I guess, and the more robust it makes the whole market. So it's a good thing.
One thing that wasn't in there is that there's no ag visa, which is something that the VFF and NFF has been calling on for a long time. Do you think it's never going to happen?
Oh, look, I suspect whenever we hear announcements in other directions, like this is what we're doing to the seasonal workers program, or this is what we're doing to get more, unemployed Australians on farms, and all of those little announcements always kind of, to me, sound like a good excuse not to give us an ag visa. I am probably waning a little bit in my hope for an ag visa. Having said that, though, it doesn't have to be exactly a program as we've designed it. We're putting forward suggestions to government because we know what the struggles are in horticultural businesses particularly, and why we're after an ag visa and the specific nuances as to why it has to be, designed in that way. But again, we're just looking for a productive and efficient workforce, and we'll take that by any means that we actually are offered it.
There's funding that's been put aside for a farm labour trial at Sunraysia. Can you tell us about that?
So it was a bit scant on details, and as we've been throwing around a lot of ideas, and the Sunraysia is one of the areas that we thought was a really great place to pilot a program of an ag visa or an amnesty, or that, there's really specific labour challenges and shortages in that region. Now they're saying that there'll be a pilot of the seasonal workers program. Well, we all know that the seasonal workers program already exists. The pilot, I think, from the indications that we've had from the department, sound like they're going to be removing some of the barriers that make it quite difficult for smaller growers to access the seasonal worker program. So the pilot will be allowing smaller growers on there, and differences in, the red tape so that smaller growers can access that. I think that means that we don't really want to give you the ag visa again, and that the coalition particularly are very, very dedicated to the seasonal workers program, which is both a good and bad thing. And but at the end of the day, like I said, we're just looking for labour on farms, and beggars can't be choosers, I guess, at a point.
Drought is obviously another big issue. We didn't see a national drought policy, but the government says it's going to spend $3 million on expanding the farm household allowance system. So people that have destocked, for example, those funds will be exempt. So it might open up a few more people to applying for the allowance. But What does that really do to help farmers now? Have you found the federal government's been left wanting when it comes to drought assistance in the budget?
I guess the biggest issue that we've had with drought assistance, not just in this budget, but all the various iterations of drought assistance, is that it often misses a lot of people. And the way businesses are structured means that it can often miss farmers that are really doing it tough. People who have got off-farm income into their farming businesses to keep them, you know, diversified and robust and give them a bit of diversity around income around these really difficult times are often missed out as well. So I guess when you're looking at policies helping people in a tough time, you've just got to make sure that you're not disadvantaging some groups of people that are actually, you know, really doing it tough. And then other people that have drought-proofed and spent money on innovation and making sure that we don't take any innovation out of businesses by giving handouts. So we always want to see that humanitarian aspect met. So hopefully some of these extensions actually go some ways to making sure that people can do things like pay school fees and get food on the table when their farming business is in big trouble. So any expansions to those assistance measures are good, but it's really complicated, and sometimes there's broad brush strokes around what assistance looks like, and hopefully this cleans up some of the gaps, I guess, that exist.
And just lastly, your New South Wales counterpart, the New South Wales Farmers Association, has said this morning it would be churlish not to give the budget a pass for farmers. Do you agree?
Oh, it's really difficult because I know how budgets work in my own business. There's a lot of things that underpin the assumptions that are made in budgets. So they are announcements, and you know, there's winners and losers in every budget. And I guess, the way I approach it is the government's just telling us where they're going to spend the money, and wherever they tell you they're going to spend the money, it sounds like a great thing, but there's other places that miss out. So I'd say it's neutral, and it is what it is. And for me, it's all about allowing farmers to be adaptable to change that happens, and whether that's climate change and variability or political change and policy change, that we really need to be focusing on making sure that farm businesses are robust so that they are resilient in times of change. And I guess a federal budget being handed down is just another indication of changes that might come. And again, there's good and bad in all budgets. So it's about making sure that farmers know how to, you know, take the benefits and mitigate some of the things that are drawbacks in any particular budget.
That was VFF Vice President Emma Germano giving the federal budget a neutral rating for farmers. What do you think? You can let me know by texting 0467 842 722.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, it's 22 past 12 and my name's Isabella Pittaway. Thanks so much for your company. And look, while there was no money for an agriculture visa or a national drought policy, the federal budget includes another $18.3 million to help the effort to eradicate deadly red fire ants and another $9.2 million towards yellow crazy ant control in Queensland. Andrew Cox from the Invasive Species Council has welcomed news the government hasn't backed down on introducing a biosecurity import levy on shipping containers.
It's not as strong as last year in terms of the investment in invasive species and biosecurity, but what we were worried about was the revenue raising that measure from last year's budget, which was to put a levy on shipping containers and other cargo, which was going to generate about $300 million a year. We were worried that because of the pushback from some of the importers that was going to get dropped. Well, fortunately, it's not. It's going to get delayed a couple of months. And all of that new spending on biosecurity, which we would fund, is still in the budget.
Why is that so important? I understand it applies to shipping containers, and there has been some concern that it's singling them out when air transport and the like is not being targeted.
Yeah, look, the levy arose from an independent review of biosecurity a couple of years ago, and it recommended that the importers, which are creating the biosecurity risk and responses like fire ants of, you know, having to spend lots of government money, it was recommended to be levied on all imports by shipping, by air and passenger movements, international tourists. And they've gone ahead with the levy on the shipping imports, containers and bulk goods, but they've recommended the other two to go ahead, and that's being looked at, and I think it might be phased in subsequent years. So that's certainly part of a steering group that's just been set up to look at the implementation of the levy.
So you're hoping it will be applied more broadly?
Absolutely. I think the governments have endorsed in principle the full range of sources for the levy, including the passenger movements and the air containers. The passenger movements, there is a legislative limit to it can't come in until 2022. So we're really strongly supportive that it covers all imports, because that's where the biosecurity risk is. It's not just the shipping containers and bulk goods that are causing the biosecurity risk. You know, air containers, for example, come in very quickly and could be distributed over large parts of Australia in a short period of time, and they are a serious biosecurity risk as well.
And I understand there is some more funding for fire ant control, which is a very big issue for Queensland and, in fact, the nation if they spread.
Yeah, look, if they don't eradicate red imported fire ants from southeast Queensland, south of Brisbane, we will have fire ants across the whole country. There's no doubt about it. And the massive, you know, billions of dollars worth of cost and the health and agricultural impacts and the environmental impacts. So what the budget's done, it's brought forward some money from the federal government, $18 million extra to this program. Now, it's already a big program, $411 million over 10 years. But by bringing forward the money, it means they can get on top of it earlier. I think what we've learnt with fire ants, the more you spend early in the program, the more success you'll get later on. And I think this is a wise thing. And I understand that Queensland government is planning to top that up as well. It's funded by all the states and federal government, but this is a new injection of funding to get on top of the job.
Andrew Cox, you're concerned that there's an absence of funding for a national centre to control the weed, a national centre to coordinate the weed research effort for Australia.
That's right. Since the axing of the Weeds Cooperative Research Centre in 2008, which was a national body developing solutions to weed problems across the country, there's been no institution to replace it. And that's been a major gap in the research effort. We need more coordination amongst the states. We need the development of biological controls, and we need the refinement of the control measures. This is essential just to make sure we've got all the tools available to make a difference.
Andrew Cox from the Invasive Species Council speaking with Jennifer Nichols. Well, let's move away from the budget now, and the beef industry seems to be facing an endless line of questions and claims about its sustainability and environmental credentials. Cow burps and farts are now viewed by many as a genuine threat to the climate. But is Australia's grass-fed beef industry selling itself short? The World Wildlife Fund thinks yes, as Dan Fitzgerald reports.
Ian McConnell is a fifth-generation beef producer who also works for the World Wildlife Fund. He's been looking at the environmental credentials of the cattle industry in Australia's northern rangelands and believes it has a good story to tell.
There's a whole range of environmental credentials that need to be measured and validated that are an opportunity for northern cattlemen. It's really great intact natural savanna. It should be a place where the global market is coming to find beef that is verified deforestation free. It is an opportunity. It's one of the few natural ecosystems in the world that's steady state for soil carbon. Now, you know, the land management here has meant we're not emitting carbon from the soils at a great rate that's measured steady. And the ecosystem services, the wildlife that exists in those systems, still exist with cattle and food production happening in those systems. So there's a whole lot of claims, but we need to be able to validate and verify that so that when the claims are made, that you can stand beside them and know that they're absolutely bulletproof.
Mr. McConnell says Australia's beef industry has done some good work to promote its sustainability achievements and goals, but there's more work to be done.
I think the carbon neutral ambition of the Australian beef industry is a game changer globally. It's something that if they achieve, it does address one of the major challenges of the Australian beef industry, of the beef industry anywhere in the world. In terms of changing the opinions, we're still at the position of trying to find the data. You know, groups like the Australian Beef Sustainability Framework, which is managed by MLA, is doing a great job of trying to compile the data around what is the true data set that the Australian industry can use around their environmental performance so that we can communicate not only the data to industry, to consumers, sorry, but also think about how do we actually start to move these needles in the right direction and set goals for where we want these data sets to actually be.
You've spoken about cattle producers needing to take ownership of the bad. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think in every industry, you have performers that are performing below an agreed threshold. The challenge is, what do you do about it? What do you do, you know, how does an industry set in place, whether it be in some other industries, codes of practice or best practice guidelines that say, you know, below that line, we can't defend you or represent you to the community. You're not part of the same industry, you're not producing the same product with the same values that our industry espouses to. That's really important that we do that, because the biggest risk to the industry, whether it be on animal welfare or environmental grounds, will be those that are actually performing at the bottom. It's when they're showcased and you can't prove that they're an outlier that it becomes pasted across the entire industry. And right now we don't have the data or the ability to say that is an outlier. This is what the whole of industry actually looks like.
While the World Wildlife Fund might not seem like a likely ally for Australia's cattle industry, Mr. McConnell says there's a lot of common goals between the two going forward.
Our job is to raise awareness of the problems so that solutions can be found. But the way we work, especially in the beef industry, is to work through collaborative efforts. So the Global Roundtable of Sustainable Beef and the 12 national roundtables that sit under that around the world are places where we're able to engage with industry and producers and say, these are the environmental outcomes we want to see. How do we do it? And we rely on farmers and industry groups to tell us, this is how we get there. How do we value it when we get there? How do we create that change at scale so that it's a win-win for farming and the environment? And those discussions have led to some great outcomes. You can buy verified beef in Canada. In Brazil, groups like Embrapa through the roundtable have now got a certified carbon neutral beef product on the shelves. So there's some great outcomes around the world, and I think that style of collaboration has meant that there's a lot of trust and validity around the claims coming out of those systems. But it's also a really unique place to have some really tough discussions and actually find common solutions.
That's Ian McConnell, global commodity leader of beef with the World Wildlife Fund, ending that report by Dan Fitzgerald. You're listening to The Country Hour. My name's Isabella Pittaway and it's a touch over 12:30. Let's get the latest in news headlines, and it's good afternoon to Amelia Bernasconi.
Good afternoon, Isabella. A man will face court today after being charged in relation to a hit-and-run collision in Echuca last month. The 23-year-old has been charged with negligently causing serious injury and other driving-related offences. The 39-year-old victim remains in hospital in a serious condition. Police have charged a 32-year-old man from Darley near Bacchus Marsh as part of an investigation into an alleged serious sexual and physical assault last week. Sexual Crime Squad detectives allege the man met the victim, a 39-year-old female Vietnamese woman, via a dating app and imprisoned and assaulted her over 4 days after starting a relationship with her. He'll face court later this week. Victoria's Family Violence Prevention Minister says the conviction of George Pell has increased demand for sexual assault counselling services across the state. The Victorian government has announced $5 million of additional counselling and support services at centres against sexual assault to meet the increase in demand. The government says funding will provide counselling and support for an additional 2,800 survivors statewide. South Gippsland Shire Council has had a second person reject taking up a position as councillor for the second time this week. The council has held 2 countbacks for a vacancy in the Tarwin ward and will hold another next week. It comes as the state government has given the council 28 days to explain why it should not be suspended after 4 councillors have resigned in the space of 5 months. $50,000 has been pledged to Lifeline Gippsland to boost its services to assist locals affected by recent bushfires and the ongoing drought. Victoria's Mental Health Minister Martin Foley made the announcement this morning. He says the funds will provide additional support to those doing it tough through school and workplace visits and increased presence at recovery centres and community events. And Portland's Incitec Pivot fertiliser manufacturing plant will close in May, leading to job losses believed to affect at least 30 employees. The company said in a statement, a review found its Portland plant was not globally competitive. And for more stories, you can visit our website at abc.net.au/news.
Thanks, Amelia. Let's cross now to the Weather Bureau, where senior forecaster Richard Carline has the latest details. Richard, it was quite mild last night.
That's right, Isabella. We were ahead of a cold front and the northerly wind was freshening and conditions were a little milder, certainly milder than the morning before that where we had light winds and clearer skies. But that cold front I mentioned, it's moved into the southwest of the state and it is cooling things off a little with the winds turning to the south and the temperatures dropping towards the mid-teens. On the radar, it does look impressive with some rain returns there, but it is falling out of fairly high level clouds, so we're not expecting a huge amount of rainfall. The rainfall is fairly light. The highest rainfall we've had so far since 9 o'clock is just 1.4 millimetres at Portland, a few other falls of around a millimetre. We may see some falls of 2 to 8 millimetres in the southwest through the afternoon as that light rain continues. But for remaining southern and mountain districts, the band of precipitation with the front will tend to weaken, so most falls there should be less than 5 millimetres. Some of the shower activity will reach the northern plains, but just the southern extremes, most of the northern plains will stay dry. And up in the northwest, temperatures heading for 30 degrees. Remaining northern areas around the mid to high 20s, also mid to high 20s for Gippsland. But with this early arrival of the cold front, temperatures have already reached their peak, which was around 20 degrees, and have since fallen to the mid-teens. Now, during tomorrow, that cold front will move away to the east fairly quickly. We'll have showers in southern and mountain districts contracting to Gippsland during the afternoon. There is a slight chance of a thunderstorm along the East Gippsland coast around late morning, early afternoon. And if that came off, there could be some falls of 10 to 20 millimetres over that East Gippsland coast. But apart from that, most totals tomorrow will be less than 5 millimetres. The shower should be easing later in the day and mostly clearing, with fine conditions over the northern plains. So a little milder tomorrow, but still temperatures in the north between 25 and 29 degrees and temperatures in the south around the high teens or low 20s. Friday looks as though it'll be the warm day for the next week. Northerly winds returning, they'll freshen through the day. It should be dry for most of the day, but we'll see temperatures up to the low 30s in the north, the high 20s in the south. With those gusty northerly winds developing, a cold front enters the southwest late on Friday night. That will bring some isolated showers and thunderstorms that are mainly fine Friday. That front moves through early Saturday morning and the winds will swing to the west and drop out fairly quickly. Scattered showers over southern and mountain areas will contract to the east through the day. Then Sunday looks like a mostly fine day as a high-pressure ridge moves across the state. Monday, the next front's due. Looks like that'll be during the second half of Monday. We'll see scattered showers develop from the west, mainly over southern and mountain districts. And then once that goes through, it looks as though a slow-moving high will dominate weather for the rest of the week that will just pass to the south of us. So it'll stay cool for a few days next week, but with those showers in the south are slowly easing. So we haven't got too much of extreme weather over the next week, but we will be affected by two or three fronts. Not going to have much impact for the north of the state in terms of rainfall, but we'll see a smattering of showers, I think, in the south over most of the next week.
And I think anything over Gippsland as well, if we did get anywhere between that 10 and 20 for East Gippsland tomorrow, would be fantastic. Thanks, Richard.
Thanks, Isabella.
That's Richard Carline, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
My name's Isabella Pidaway and it's 21 minutes to one. As the drought and high input costs continue to bite, the Victorian Dairy Lobby has turned to the state government. The United Dairy Farmers of Victoria joined other dairy organisations asking for cash flow assistance for Northern Victorian dairy farmers last week. UDV President Paul Mumford told Simone Smith help was required as soon as possible.
So I met with the Minister for Agriculture, Declan Symes, last week with industry delegates, and that was a very rewarding meeting with her. So I made it quite clear to the Minister that it's imperative that we action something sooner than later, that the impending issues facing farmers, particularly in the north, will transpire within weeks. So our action must be within days to come up with a solution. There was many things spoken about, but essentially we said to the minister that it's here and now, and essentially that would have to come in the form of a cash or cash flow equivalent support packages of some sort. But more importantly, we also need to address the long-term issues, and water was one of those that we need to fix for the long-term sustainability of the dairy industry.
Paul, how much cash did you ask for?
Well, I can't actually say, but it was substantial cash is required here and now. There is farmers hemorrhaging in the north and right across the state for that matter. So, yes, it's quite substantial.
What was Minister Symes' reaction?
She's extremely favourable in working towards a solution. What's more important now is that we actually get the job done, and that the Daniel Andrews government actually values those communities and actually authorises any support packages that may be brought to the front here and centre.
When do you expect to hear anything from the minister? You said it's within days.
Yeah, so we're working with the minister's department right now. Again, I have said the importance of coming up with solutions sooner than later. So our next discussions are later this week.
So basically, the package is for cash flow injection for dairy farmers. Is that correct?
That's right. That's our wish list. That we have to look at both here and now to help farmers through this short-term period. But more importantly, we've also got to come up with solutions for the longer-term sustainability of the industry.
Sure. And will this be just used for water, this money?
Again, I highlight that it was a cash flow equivalent. So it's the bank accounts that are hemorrhaging in farmers' eyes right at the moment. So, you know, it may be a myriad of different ways of how we achieve that. It may be cash. It may be support in other areas like rebates on rate, for example.
If you were successful in being able to get this cash flow assistance, what farmers would be eligible?
I would hope that it's eligible for all dairy farmers right across the north.
That's UDV President Paul Mumford speaking there to Simone Smith. A spokesman for Victorian Agriculture Minister Jacqueline Symes confirmed the meeting with the dairy industry and said the minister would be in Northern Victoria meeting with dairy farmers at the end of the week, where assistance and cash flow would be some of the topics discussed. Well, here's a story about thinking a little bit differently. Airports could be the next big thing in growing livestock feed. A 4-hectare trial site of lucerne is being grown near the runway at Adelaide Airport in conjunction with SA Water. The crop has helped lower temperatures in the vicinity, which has the added benefit of helping planes take off. Greg Ingleton from SA Water told Brooke Neindorf they came up with the idea to try and green up the space around the runway with the view to keep temperatures down.
So we've just got a couple of hose and reel irrigation systems down there, and we had set them up just to demonstrate if we could cool the air down within the irrigation area compared to outside of the irrigation area. I should add, the reason that we looked at the Adelaide Airport is we have a couple of different sources of alternative water down there as well, which if it's not used, it actually just runs out to sea. So it was a way that we could actually get a beneficial use out of that water. And during the setup of the trial, I was talking to one of the maintenance guys out there, and he wasn't too supportive of it because he'll have to mow the grass more if we're irrigating it. My comeback to that was, well, why don't we grow something that when we cut it, you guys actually make some money out of it? And hence the reason for choosing lucerne to have a go.
So the airport, is that the main reason why you have to drop the temperatures around there, is because of the planes coming and going?
Yes, the biggest issue on hot days is that the planes actually can't take off with their full payload, and it's a problem at many airports around the world that there's a certain temperature, and once the surface temperature or the air temperature around the runway gets above that, they actually have to take off payload off the, or the, which is cargo, off the planes. Knowing that, we thought, well, let's see how what type of temperature reduction we can get. But it was interesting because it wasn't what we'd thought of at the start. It wasn't one of the benefits that we thought about when we first started the trial. It was really aimed at cooling the air so that it might be cooler around the terminal and the air conditioners would use less energy. But after a conversation with a friend of mine who's a pilot, we became aware that the benefits to the aircraft performance are quite significant. Yeah, so hence the reason why we wanted to explore this a bit further.
So was Lucerne the first trial that you put in, or did you try other styles of plants?
We tried some other grasses, and we also had a patch where we just added water, so whatever was there was growing. But the reason we chose Lucerne is the one thing that you don't want at an airport is to attract birds. So we chose Lucerne because it doesn't have a seed head, and you cut it when it flowers, when it's sort of 5 to 10% flowering. So we figured that that was a good way to mitigate any bird issues. And the interesting thing about the birds at the airport, just sort of standing back and watching them, and I'm not a bird expert, but you see them sort of, the main flocking birds, which I hear are the biggest risk to for airstrikes, they like to dig in the soil and they get the seeds and the grubs out of the soil. But if you've got a nice thick crop of Lucerne over the top of it, they can't actually get to the soil, and the movement of the crop with the wind also spooks them a little, so they can't actually get settled. So yeah, we're finding that it's actually quite a good bird deterrent.
And like you said, Lucerne I guess can also then be cut into hay and then sold as stock feed.
Well yeah, it's a fairly valuable crop for within the constraints of also the height constraints of what you can grow around an airport, but also that, you know, not having a seed head and having a plant that you can utilise and get value out of, which is what Lucerne ticks all the boxes for.
And now you're looking to extend the trial plot, is that correct?
Yeah, we've got a plan at the moment. We're just gathering up a bit more information to support the business case so that we can put in a centre pivot. So both SA Water and Adelaide Airport are discussing how we progress to the next stage. And so, yeah, we're just sort of getting that business case developed so that we can put the centre pivot in, and that'll increase the area to about 7 hectares of Lucerne. And we're also keen then to start to look at some of the other benefits that we might be able to get, if there's a soil carbon benefit that we might be able to get, similar to the carbon farming methods that are out there. And you know, potentially in the future it might actually become, there might be another income or a benefit from capturing that carbon in the soil. We're sort of wondering, once we get the information of the carbon, whether that would be a selling point that we could take to the airlines and look at some sort of co-investment, and you know, they get a benefit from it with the carbon, and we'd get the benefit from the sale of the Lucerne, or the airport would, sorry.
So, Greg, is this something that you can see being done at a regional airport, for example?
Absolutely. It's well known that some of the regional airports actually operate at a loss, and we were thinking that if there was a good water source that was available and wasn't, you know, wasting good drinking water, for instance, that if you had an alternative water or groundwater there, that it would be a good crop to be growing. You get the benefit to the airlines. The propeller planes don't get as big a benefit as the jet engines, but it's still a really good use of the land that would otherwise just sort of sit there quite fallow. And I mean, I know a lot of airports, they do have a winter hay cutting program, but over summer there's nothing produced there. So if they could get a summer crop out of it, that would be a big benefit to them.
Greg Ingleton from SA Water speaking there with Brooke Neindorfen. What an idea that was.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Where it is 12 minutes to one, my name's Isabella Pidaway. Data compiled by a leading grain market analyst shows the value of debt from failed Australian grain companies since 2000 is more than $130 million. Western Victorian grain buyer Lempier Grain went into administration last month, owing millions of dollars to farmers. And in October last year, Walgett-based Special One Grain collapsed, owing more than $10 million to unsecured creditors. Reporter Angus Verley spoke to Andrew Whitelaw from Mercado about what farmers can do to avoid being hurt.
Obviously, in the last week, we've seen Lempier Grain go into administration. And I guess It's pretty hard. The counterparty risk is a hard thing to get right, especially in the grains industry when it can be quite volatile. So typically we would say, you know, you can do credit checks, you can assess whether that buyer is effectively financially sound. Do they have assets? You know, if that company's got assets, at least if it goes, you know, belly up, you can hopefully get something back. You can do things like PPSR, which is a way of protecting or having a security over the grain itself. But then there's also things like reducing the payment terms. So instead of getting paid in 30 days, you know, you've got a lot more security if you get paid in 5 days. Doesn't protect it all completely. And then there's counterparty insurance. Not many farmers take it out, but it is possible to insure against default from a trading company. But I think one of the probably most important ones is have a chat around with local neighbours as well. Look for any red flags if there is any, such as if their neighbour's not been paid within the allocated time frame, then that would be a bit of a flag.
Now, you've looked back over the past 18 years at grain companies that have become insolvent. Did those companies have anything in common?
The reality is that all of them have been pretty much the smaller scale companies. And I guess if you look at the bigger sort of companies out there, you know, I guess to name them, it's pretty easy. The big multinationals, the CBH, the GrainCorp, you've got a much reduced risk of insolvency with those businesses because they have the capacity to weather the volatility of the grain market.
So does that mean that farmers should be erring on the side of caution and just selling to those big players?
Well, no, I think it's just a case of not having all of your eggs in one basket is one thing. So don't sell your 100% of your production to one company. And don't always chase the dollar. Let's say, for instance, you've got a company that wants to buy your grain at $310 a ton, but every other company is at $300, then that's probably as much of a big flag because the market is the market and there tends not to be those very big premiums. So I think, yes, we need small players and we need big players because we want the competition in the market. But if you look at it historically, it has been the smaller players which have been the worst impacted.
How about selling your grain through a broker? I've spoken to people around here that have sold through a broker and the broker has sold that grain onto a company that did go under and the sellers weren't really aware of where their grain was actually going. So what's the merit of using a broker or not using a broker?
Well, a broker is going to give you... There's a potentially that brokers will parcel your grain up with other grain and provide a better price. They help you from having to chase around the market to find what the prices are. Also, a lot of them will help with things like administration, like the paperwork and various things like transferring the grain for you. Some of them, I believe, do offer, or at least in the past, have offered some form of counterparty insurance to protect. My key thing with that is if somebody says they're offering guaranteed payments or counterparty insurance, don't take it on face value. Ask to see a copy of the insurance statement of advice so you know what it actually covers. But a broker, they have a place in the industry and they offer a service which is valuable for some, and some people want to do it themselves.
Clearly, it's been a very tough season and that's put pressure on the whole supply chain, but as well as grain companies. What prospect do you think there is that we could see more companies going under in the immediate term?
Well, it's hard to say. Like, we don't yet know the reason why Lemprea Grain has been in such strife. We don't know whether it's because of the market volatility or just making speculation on that. But in a year like this, you know, there is heightened risks. It wouldn't surprise me if there were other ones that would become insolvent this year. But if there was to be one, we don't know who it would be.
That was grain market analyst Andrew Whitelaw speaking there to Angus Verley. And it is time for us to head off to the markets. First up today is Leon Gather Cattle with Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Isabella. There were 1,500 more than the sale of a fortnight ago, with the usual buyers operating in a dearer market. Quality improved with more prime lots and a lot of cows. Trade cattle gained 20 cents. Grown steers and bullocks lifted 15 to 20. Friesian and crossbred steers kicked up 20. Cows gained 10 to 30 cents, with processors loading cows for an estimated 324 to 425 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls sold firm. Grown steers, 270 to 305. Bullocks, 284 to 314. Heavy Frisians, 209 to 252. Crossbreds, 224 to 289. Most light and medium weight cows, 120 to 210. Heavyweights, 171 to 245. Better shaped heavy bulls, 217 to 240. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting from Leongatha with 500 cows still to be sold.
Thanks, Brendan. And now with Warrnambool Cattle, here's Caroline Ronald.
Good afternoon. Numbers continue to lift with 1,548 cattle penned this week at Warrnambool. The quality was quite good with some excellent grown steers and bullocks offered, with processors going the extra mile to fill orders. The usual buying group was in attendance and operating in a fluctuating market across categories. Trade steers, $2.55 to $3, easing 10 cents. Trade heifers, $2.66 to $2.82, dropping up to 13 cents. Yearlings to feed, firm to 13 cents better. Steers, $2.40 to $2.75. Heifers, $2.32 to $2.60. Grown steers jumped 9 cents, $2.50 to $3. Bullocks lifted 7 cents, $2.58 to $3. Grown heifers, 10 cents dearer, $2.10 to $2.75. Cows ease, 6 to 13 cents in places. Heavy 4-score beef cows, $2.09 to $2.30. Tops of the dairy portion selling for $2.08. Medium 2-score cows, $1.38 to $1.82. Bulls with shape, $2.30 to $2.36, with the dairy portion selling between $1.80 and $2.05. I'm Caroline Ronald for MLA.
Thanks, Caroline. And now with Wodonga Cattle, here's Leanne Dax.
Numbers more than doubled, with agents yarding 720 cows with less buyers at the rail. Demand did weaken overall weights and grades. Heavy cows sold 11 cents cheaper, 196 to 212. Middle runner D2 and D3 linotype slipped 2 to 8 cents, making from 132 to 176. The dairy portion, 132 to 185. They were back 7. Bulls firmed a few cents better for the well-shaped boys, 180 to 220. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. And now with Hamilton Lambs, we've got Tim Delaney.
Good afternoon. A larger supply at Hamilton of 10,500 lambs are sold. The grid of most of the regular buyers. Demand continues to remain strong. Quality varied from plain to good. Some more presented heavy lambs, good grass and medium tray weights, and many lightweight 1 and 2 score lambs unfinished. Restocking and feeder did provide some excellent competition, paying most between $95 to $140. Heavy lambs sold $10 to $15 dearer. Medium lambs were firm to $3 stronger. Light lambs sold unchanged. Lightweight 2-score lambs made $90 to $118. Light tray weights $112 to $148, averaging 715 cents. Medium tray weight 3-score lambs $142 to $162. Heavier tray weights $156 to $171 to average 690 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy 3 and 4-score lambs made from $165 to $185. Extra heavy lambs $190 to $225, averaging 680 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Sheep numbers are similar at 7,000. Another yarding of mixed weights. More lightweight mutton appearing. Mark was weaker, as light sheep sold $3 to $5 easier, medium up was equal, and heavy sheep sold $15 to $25 cheaper. Lightweight sheep made $60 to $93, averaging 440 cents. Medium 2 and 3 scores $90 to $122. The Merino ewe mutton averaging 510 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy crossbred ewe sold $126 to $212, averaging 525 cents. Medium weight Merino weather sold from $99 to $123 as they average close to 520 cents a kilogram carcass weight. This has been Tim Delaney reporting for MLA Hamilton.
Thanks, Tim. And lucky last, we have Horsham sheep with Graham Pimer.
Good afternoon, everyone. Both lamb and sheep numbers lifted on top of the stronger returns of the past week. Lamb supply was at 8,350 with a good selection of all weights yarded. Most of these buying group operated in a firm slightly easier market, with the trade in heavy lambs reaching $2 to $5 and the export weight lambs selling similar. Heavy lambs made to $225 and the 22 to 24 kg lambs sold from $152 to $168 and good quality merino lambs sold from $128 to $166.50. Restock was paid from $86 to $159. 4,700 sheep pending, putting some good runs across bred merino sheep. They sold the king competition with medium weight sheep to $5 dearer in places. The heavy sheep easier on last week's extreme levels. Heavy merino weathers and a big skin sold at $234. Light trade weight lambs sold from $129 to $151, the average around $680. The medium trade weight lambs 22 to 24 sold from $152 to $168, they average around $660. Export 3 and 4 score lambs 26 to 30 sold from $176 to $198. The extra heavy export lambs sold from $206 to $225, they've averaged around $645. Medium weight sheep sold from $77 to $126, with Ryan Merino mutton averaging around $470 to $480. It's been Grant Pyman, Horsham for MLA.
Thanks, Graham. And that's all we've got time for on the Country Hour today. I will be back again tomorrow. If you want any further information on the budget and what it means for agriculture and farming, you can head online onto ABC Rural. It's 1 o'clock, news time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.